Who can ascend God's holy mountain? Who can ascend to the heavens and reach God? I had chosen this topic selfishly because I love the mountains. We grew up with the cottage in the Berg, and I loved going there. The grand views, the feeling of reaching the top, it's an undeniable feeling that when I was at the top, that I could feel closer to God. And it's not that I was convinced that He dwells there, but the sheer cliffs and the towering peaks always reminded me of how small I was. I also love the mountains because of the connections I've made there. My closest friendships were made on these trips. What, looking back, they felt like pilgrimages into the mountains, where we would either tent or camp in a cave, and we'd go trekking out with only the bare essentials. Something about that really broke down barriers, all pretenses, and I found that I would discover more about myself, I would discover more about others, and very importantly, God. But it's not just me who had this feeling about mountains. The biblical authors did too. The mountain imagery is so rich in both the Old and the New Testament. For example, we've got Psalm 121. I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. The sense of looking up and seeing, because these high towering peaks there, that is where God would be, up in the heavens. Psalm 65, verse 6. Who formed the mountains by your power, having armed yourself with strength? When you see these incredible cliffs, we're so blessed with the Drakensberg. You see them and you see how massive they are. You really do get a sense of God's power, because if these things were created by God's hand, that's a pretty big and powerful hand. Or Psalm 46. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth give way and the mountains fall into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam and the mountains quake with their surging. This is an image of God protecting through even the worst kind of scenarios. Imagine these beautiful cliffs, there we go, being thrown into the heart of the sea. You cannot really imagine something more movable than these cliffs. Which leads me on to my next point, is that there's a permanence to these mountains. And the authors often look at how permanent they are. Jesus even himself, when you look at the beautiful Drakensberg, it's easy to be reminded that putting a mountain there that big is no small task. And even smaller and even more difficult task would probably be removing it. And yet Jesus uses this metaphor for doing the impossible with his disciples. Matthew 17 says, because you have so little faith, truly I say to you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible to you. Imagine trying to tell that mountain to move. It's no wonder these mountains seem so unchangeable, and it's used as this image. From the view from our little cottage was the one on the left, and that's about 15 years ago. And 2 weeks, not a bit longer than 2 weeks ago now, but we went there with the Armstrongs, you know, who are Serena's getting married, to that same cottage, and very little has changed about those mountains. Especially compared to us, I managed to find that as well. The one little one in the middle is me, so that 15 years ago, compared to us, these mountains are immovable, okay? They are unchanging. And yet we're told that God is above them and created them and is even more unchanging. But what had me thinking about these mountains even more is every day at Grace College, running around, are three houses. And they are named Ararat, Sinai, and Carmel. I had made an assumption at school at Grace, for those of you who don't know, I work there, that since these were the kids' house names, that their namesakes, they would know what these mountains were, or at least that they were mountains. Alas, I expected too much, as I found out in a few class discussions. They had little to no idea about what their namesakes were. And so I'll try not make that same mistake and assume that you guys know what it is. But these are mountains in the Bible. Okay, each a place where God came and met with his people. But more specifically with three men. Noah, Moses, and Elijah. Starting with Noah in... Oh, there we go. Okay, an Ararat. A towering mountain in modern-day Turkey. High enough that most of the year these peaks are snow-covered. But in the Bible, Ararat isn't just a beautiful mountain range. Genesis 8 verse 4, and on the seventh day of the month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. It is on this mountain, thanks AI for these, is where, I didn't actually get those pictures. It is on this mountain where the ark came to rest after Noah in faith went and built it for years before the flood actually came. This mountain is a symbol of God's grace, his mercy, and his provision, even in judgment. It was on this peak that the ark came to rest in Genesis after the flood saved Noah and his family. Next is Mount Sinai, a peak that forms part of the Sinai Peninsula. It's a place that draws pilgrims, hikers, and travelers from all over the world because of its biblical history. It is probably the most well-known mountain in the Bible, and it is incredibly rich with symbolism and history. It is also my favorite, and I think the Grace Colleges as well, because somehow everyone who is sporty gets placed in Mount Sinai. I think Francie needs to check up on that bias, but anyway. This is the place where God came and met with Moses. Exodus 19. On the morning of the third... can't read off my notes, so I'm going to leave you guys behind. On the morning of the third day, there was thunder and lightning, with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. The smoke billowed up from it like a smoke from a furnace. The whole mountain trembled violently, and the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. Then Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. The Lord descended to the top of Mount Sinai and called Moses to the top of the mountain. And so Moses went up. For me, this is terrifying and awesome. No one was allowed to approach this mountain, not even the animals. If they did, they would be put to death. It is here where Moses ascended, received the law, and saw God's glory. It is an amazing, amazing story, an amazing place in the Bible. It is here where God shows his glory to his people, his holiness, and his set-apartness. Through Moses, who is perhaps the most revered person in the Old Testament. And lastly, Carmel, who, those of you know, apparently Kate was a part of this. And when I said that it's probably the least impressive looking mountain, she got very offended. Because although it is a beautiful mountain range, a green ridge stretching along the Mediterranean coast of northern Israel, it's very well known for its greenery, its cliffs, and its beautiful views over the sea. It was here where Elijah had a showdown against the prophets of Baal. So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. Elijah went before the people and said, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." But the people said nothing. This is where Elijah called fire down from heaven. It is a place where God also calls his people to choose, who will you serve? Which God? It is a symbol of boldness, courage, and spiritual clarity. But there's a problem with these mountains, or rather these men. While they showcase God's power and presence, they also show our inability to measure up. It can be easy for me to try and tell you that you must try and be like these men, to ascend God's hill, but remember, it was only Noah's family who were allowed on the ark. Everyone else was destroyed. They were the only ones to get atop of Ararat. Every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out, men and animals, the creatures that move along the ground, and the birds of the air were wiped from the earth. Only Noah was left, and those with him in the ark. Or what about Sinai? Only Moses was allowed to ascend. The rest, even if they even tried, were destroyed. Put limits for the people about the mountain. Be careful that you do not approach. Be careful that you do not go up the mountain or touch the foot of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. He shall surely be stoned or shot with arrows. Not a hand is to be laid on him. Whether man or animal, he shall not be permitted to live. Only when the ram's horn sounds a long blast, they may go to the mountain. What about Elijah, who on Carmel stood alone as all the prophets of Baal and those who were meant to be God's people stood against him? Then Elijah said to them, "I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets." We get a sense of the exclusivity of these mountains, and very few get to climb it. Often in these stories, we like to imagine ourselves as the heroes, like the Moseses, the Noahs, or the Elijahs. But how much more likely are we to be the ones who laughed as Noah built the ark, or a cowering Israelite below Sinai as God ascended on that mountain, or just another Israelite swept away with idol worship? Take Jesus referencing the ark. "For in those days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man." They had no idea it was coming, and then suddenly it arrived. Exodus. "When the people saw that Moses was so long in coming down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said, 'Come, make us gods who will go before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us up out of Egypt, we don't know what has happened to him.'" Or with Elijah. "Elijah went before the people and said, 'How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is your God, follow him. But if Baal is your God, follow him.' And they said nothing." Who do we often sound more like? But what's worse than that is, although there were only a few men that got to climb these mountains, each one of them, who might be some of the people who came the closest to ascending God's mountain, still fell short. Remember in Psalm 24, the criteria, I've lost Psalm 24, is clean hands and a pure heart. Surely these men qualify. But after God had rescued Noah, he got drunk. Moses wasn't allowed to enter the promised land because he disobeyed God. And Elijah, after his incredible showdown with the prophets of Baal, ran into a forest and asked God to kill him. I can easily prepare a sermon on each of these extraordinary men, but that's not the point. My point is, there is no doubt that these were spiritual heavyweights, and yet each of them, every one of them, failed to ascend God's holy mountain. And that leads me on to my third point, which is the truth that we cannot climb it. We cannot climb high enough. And so who can climb his mountain? The psalmist asks, and the simple response is Psalm 24's criteria: clean hands, pure heart, no idols, and no lies. That seems simple enough. Yet our best efforts are filthy rags. Isaiah 64 describes them: we have all become like one who is unclean, and all our righteous deeds are like a polluted garment. We all fade like a leaf, and our iniquities like the wind take us away. That's our righteousness. Our best efforts are rags before God. And this Old Testament seems to be searching for this one. Who can ascend God's mountain? Perhaps it's David, but no, he also fell. Or maybe his son Solomon. Nope, he ends up even worse. Failure after failure. And the Old Testament ends with the question still unanswered: who can ascend God's mountain? If these giants couldn't do it, what chance do we have? What chance do I have? There isn't enough motivational videos, health supplements, or hiking gear that can get me to the top of this mountain. You cannot ascend God's mountain. We weren't enough. We weren't pure enough, clean enough, good enough. Or should I rather say, you could not. The reality is we fall short. We are not enough. And if we try to climb it in our own strength, we will fail. This would be a horrible place for the story to end. And that is where the Old Testament ends, on the unanswered question: who can ascend God's holy mountain? But luckily we know that that isn't where the story ends. Last point is the greater mountain. There's a small hill outside the gates of Jerusalem, which compared to the mountains we have spoken about already, seems much, much smaller. It's also called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. As you can see in modern day Israel, the skull is the eyes. You can sort of make out below there, it used to look like a skull. And you can just make out the face. Much more unimpressive. It's a hill, not a towering peak. But it is the most important summit in history. Why? Because 2,000 years ago, stripped naked, bearing a crown of thorns, and raw wood of a cross on his back, it would have been the hardest hill to climb. John 19. So the soldiers took charge of Jesus, carrying his own cross. He went out to the place of the skull, which in Aramaic is called Golgotha. God had seen the struggles of his people, and he knew no one could reach him. So what does God do? Instead of leaving us stranded, he came down the mountain. The answer to who can ascend God's holy mountain is no one. So God comes down himself. He humbles himself. Who being in the very, speaking in Philippians, speaking about Jesus, who in being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. God comes down, and he takes humanity into himself. From his holy mountain, he steps down and he ascends this little hill. The hill you and I deserved to climb. He is the one who had clean hands and a pure heart. He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. 1 Peter. He ascended the mountain that we couldn't climb. He was cast down so that we might be lifted up. 2 Corinthians, this is not added, but says, God made him who had no sin to be sin for us, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. He was cast down so we could be lifted up, but lifted up to where? The final mountain is Mount Zion. Hebrews 12 gives one of the most beautiful depictions of the difference between this Old Testament of the Mount Sinai versus Mount Zion. You have not come to a mountain that can be touched and that is burning with fire, to darkness, gloom, and storm, to a trumpet blast, or to such a voice speaking words that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them, because they could not bear what was commanded. If even an animal touches the mountain, it must be stoned. The sight was so terrifying that Moses said, I am trembling with fear. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the heavenly Jerusalem, the city of the living God. You have come to thousands of angels in joyful assembly. We don't climb this mountain to find God's favor. Instead, Christ has placed us there. And so, let me end with this. Every religion in the world says, climb that mountain, get to God, be better, and try harder. But Christianity is the only faith where God says, you cannot make it up that hill, but I will come down for you. At Ararat, God gave grace in judgment. At Sinai, he gave the law and his presence. At Carmel, he showed his power, but at Calvary, he gave himself. At Calvary, the one with clean hands and a pure heart ascended the hill of the Lord, not to bask in glory, but to carry a cross. And here's the irony. The only one who ever truly deserved to be on God's holy mountain, Mount Zion, which is in Jerusalem, Jesus was taken outside the city gates, outside of Jerusalem, so that we who deserved to be cast out could be brought in. So now what? What do? You do not climb to try and earn God's approval. Instead, you can live from a place where you know you already have God's approval. He has washed your hands and made your heart pure. How then do we make sure that we are? My encouragement then is to fall more and more in love with the God who did this for you. And you'll see that there's no idol that can live up to or satiate or save like he can. And to finish like I did at Grace College with their very apt motto, now you can give your utmost for his highest because he has placed us on Zion. Thank you very much, guys. I'm just going to close in prayer, is how it normally goes. And then you'll say grace. I don't need to say grace. You say grace with them. Cool. Father God, thank you so much that we could gather here today. Thank you so much that although we could not climb your holy mountain, Lord, you did it for us. You came down and you have placed us now on your Mount Zion, Lord. I pray that with everything in us, we can learn to love and fall more and more in love with you, so that everything in us will hate what you hate, that we can keep our hearts and our hands clean now, Lord. Not because we want your approval, Lord, but because you have already won our approval. Thank you so much for all that you have done. In your name.